This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is August 20th, 2020, and this is episode 203.
I'm Strat Lundeboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, 100 million Canadians, is it a good idea? Is it a great idea? Prorogation? Turns out, it's a great idea if you're Justin Trudeau, and the search for Andrew Scheer's replacement. Thanks to the 102 people who are contributing every month, would sure love to see some new names up there, so join our 102 patrons at patreon.com/politicoast and help keep the show growing. Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of a newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial. Let's jump right into the interview you had, Scott, with Lisa Lalande, the CEO of the Century Initiative, on why Canada should have 100 million people.
Joining me today is Lisa Lalande from the Century Initiative. Lisa, welcome to Politicoast.
Thank you for having me.
So let's get started. What is the Century Initiative?
Sure. The Century Initiative is really a group of Canadians committed to Canada's future. We're motivated by a vision for the Canada that we will leave future generations. For us, that means a Canada that's diverse, resilient, prosperous at home, and influential abroad. But we recognize that to bring that vision to life, to bring that vision of Canada to life, we need to start now. Prosperity is going to take a lot of planning. It's not going to be easy. So specifically, Century Initiative advocates for policies and we support initiatives that would increase Canada's population to 100 million by 2100. We believe that with the right approach to population growth, the right approach to population growth is necessary if we want to enhance our economic strength at home, but also our influence abroad. We believe these are necessary to create a better Canada for future generations.
So right now there's about 37.5 million Canadians. Why is that not enough? What is a low population cost in Canada right now?
So our population is not just low, it's also aging. So that means that the compassion that we Canadians pride ourselves on will quickly become unaffordable. So in other words, we're not going to be able to afford the Canada we know today. In practical terms, what does that mean? We enjoy tremendous social supports and programs. Think about our healthcare, our educational systems, to our pension and unemployment programs, our roads, our bridges, our infrastructure. All of these are largely supported by tax dollars. Tax dollars require a healthy, employed, productive population, one that's creating jobs, earning paychecks, and contributing through tax dollars, household spending, investment. So fewer people working means fewer dollars for the programs and support that we value as Canadians. And right now, our domestic birth rate simply isn't enough to close the gap. So I'm going to throw some numbers out, but I think they're important. In the 70s, the number of working people for each person over 65 was 6 to 1. Today, it's 4 to 1. By 2036, it's going to be 2 to 1. So that means that we're only going to have, for every two people, we'll have two people supporting for each elderly dependent person. And our safety net was largely designed for a time when costs could be shared more broadly. And there were some recent studies that have shown that they're now projecting even fewer babies will be born as a result of the pandemic. So given this, immigration is going to be the only realistic approach for us to protect our prosperity as a country. So Century Initiative, our perspective is we have to act now. We can't do this later. We need to leverage Canada's strengths, our openness to immigration, our value for social services, including early childhood support, to get ahead of these trends in order to build the prosperity that for future generations, our children, our children's children, generations that we're not ever going to know.
So is this mostly just a case of trying to get the GDP numbers and the tax revenue up, or is there kind of more to why a larger Canada would be beneficial for everyone?
That's a really great question. Because we focus so much on the goal of 100 million by 2100, often we get challenged with, is it just the numbers? And it's not just the numbers. It's a big part of our argument, but it's more than that. Let me explain. This 100 million scenario provides the greatest positive impact on our demographic challenges that we're facing, and will lead to higher economic growth. So yes, it is about GDP growth. Based on some research, we predict that if we steadily grow to 100 million, our GDP growth would rise to 2.6%. And that would be sufficient to significantly reduce the burden on the government revenues required to pay for healthcare, old age, other services. And if it's done right, so I want to emphasize the right part, it would mean that younger workers, it would mean more younger workers, more innovation, entrepreneurialism, and dynamism in the Canadian economy, as well as international influence. So the reason for the longer time frame to get there is simple. So I'm going to emphasize now what I started with, which is it's not just about 100 million people. It's about getting there in a smart, sustainable way, in a way that benefits everyone. So in addition to increasing our numbers, we need to plan for how, as a country, we can get there. So that means planning for and investing in things like urban development and infrastructure to support a larger population, the kinds of employment and entrepreneurship programs to attract and grow the kind of talent we need for the jobs of today, but also the jobs of tomorrow, education and early childhood supports, and skills and training, to name a few. So I think, you know, one of the questions that we often get when I post and people email me, Canadians have legitimate concerns right now, especially given COVID-19. They have legitimate concerns about increasing the number, our population size, but also the number of immigrants coming to Canada. We need to create space for that conversation, but we also need to help people see and understand the economic and social benefits of managed population growth through immigration. And we need to ensure that the benefits of increasing our population through immigration are widely felt. So that is going to take planning, long-term thinking and planning, and engagement with many different groups that could help us understand what's needed to advance that change. And we're not talking about a massive jump. We're talking about proposing gradual annual increases, not too far off from what the government has already targeted. Essentially moving towards pinning our annual immigration target to 1.25% of our population. So that's just under, today it's just under 1%. This may sound high to some, but we've actually done this before. So immigration actually peaked in the early 1900s, a year that we had 1 year in 1913 that saw over 400,000 immigrants arrive, which was more than 5% of the population. We've done this, we've done it reasonably well, and we can do it again.
Yeah, I actually was reading Doug Saunders, but the Maximum Canada, that was something that really jumped out at me, was how different and much larger the population growth was back in that time when Laurier was prime minister, as well as he thought we needed 40 million people to kind of realize Canada's potential, which now we're just kind of getting to right now. So it's quite interesting. But I want to jump into the numbers a bit here. It's noticeable that 100 million and the end of the century 2100 are both pretty round numbers. How were they chosen? And is the reason why we shouldn't be aiming for 100 million by 2075 or 100 million maybe in 2110?
Right. I mean, that kind of builds on my answer that I just gave, which was, you know, we drew on some research primarily from the Conference Board of Canada, but also on other sources. And it identified that the 100 million scenario provides the greatest positive impact on our demographic challenges. And it also pointed to higher economic growth for us. And so based on that work, we actually using that as our North Star. And we are suggesting the gradual annual increases so that we can actually, as we grow, we can consider the system level changes, the wraparound supports that are needed, the important questions that we have to ask and answer around how do we accommodate larger population size in our cities? How do we make sure that we have the right employment and skills training programs? How do we make sure that we have childcare? You know, if you're parents right now with kids, you're like, you know, you're feeling it. You need that more now than ever. So how do we make sure that we're managing this growth properly? And so what Century Initiative is advocating for this North Star goal, 100 million by 2100, and we're simultaneously saying, but let's get it right. Let's do it right. And let's work in partnership to make sure that it happens properly.
So on doing it right, you mentioned you want to grow the population sustainably, but that's something I always see come up whenever this idea of a larger population is discussed, is, well, sustainability and how it relates to climate change. Canada has one of the highest per capita carbon emissions. How do we reconcile a growing population with the need to fight climate change?
So climate change isn't just about population numbers. It's also about how we use our resources and the choices we make. In a country that is as sparsely populated as Canada, we're forced to use inefficient and highly polluting forms of transportation. So greater population density would allow us to make the economic and environmental case for using more energy efficient technologies for transportation, for example. Second, building a low carbon economy requires scale, innovation, and capital. And coping with the effects of climate change will be very expensive. The cost of these shifts are going to be to both public and private sectors will be huge. So we need a strong fiscal base to meet our environmental commitments, and this depends on population growth.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. So yeah, stuff like high-speed rail, for example, can't really work if you just have a very large dispersed population. Is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah. So, you know, population density could create nodes of economic activity. They can foster economic innovation, productivity, growth. One of the things that, you know, one of the questions that we get is where would Canadians live? Like, how is that going to work? We can't all go to Toronto or Vancouver. I live in Toronto. I understand, you know, how expensive it is and how difficult it is sometimes. So we're exploring, but we are exploring the concept of megacities. So urging land use, infrastructure, economic development policies that drive greater population density in our cities and regions across Canada. We believe properly planned greater density is energy efficient, to your earlier point, reduces environmental impact, delivers a high quality of life for residents. There are regions across the country with tremendous potential, and that would become a larger population, creating jobs, driving innovation. But I want to emphasize, because I'm also from a small town in Northern Ontario, but rural communities have long been a pillar of the Canadian economy from the agriculture sector on. And we need to ensure that the importance of rural communities stays in place. What we're saying is that, you know, we recognize that cities are already under pressure and resources are tight, particularly because of COVID-19. So to be successful, what we're saying is that communities need to have modern, high quality infrastructure, offer affordable housing and convenient public transportation, attract talent and investment and nurture innovation, provide a vibrant and inclusive cultural life. They have to feel secure and welcoming, and they have to be environmentally sustainable. So when we go back to your earlier question, you know, is it just the numbers? Is it just GDP growth? And I think that that's really short-sighted. I think it has to be both an economic argument and also about our well-being. And we believe that it doesn't have to be a one or the other, an and or. It could be both.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. So I want to touch base on the political factors related to expanding urban density. It's an issue I care quite a bit about, but it's also very contentious. Like the fights at the, you know, city councils over every small development or even the big plans, they all get pretty contentious. And there's a lot of resistance at kind of the local level to change in growth. A lot of city councils tend to have a lot of people on them who, for whatever reason, aren't particularly fond of growing the cities. How do you plan on dealing with the kind of political resistance that this proposal would bring?
Well, that's a good question. I think, you know, at the heart of Century Initiative's model is partnership, convening, identifying gaps, research gaps, practice gaps, opportunities to test new approaches. One approach that we're taking, particularly in the area of urban development, is partnering locally, partnering with organizations who are grappling with these questions, and convening organizations, groups together to explore how we might best do this. So how do we develop a 50-year infrastructure plan, for example? How do we fund that? And what are the approaches needed, and what do we test to make that happen? And so there is no sort of magic bullet, silver bullet answer. It's more about starting the conversation and supporting efforts to explore how that might happen in practice.
I see a lot of times at the local level here that a lot of conversations get started, but when they actually get to the vote at City Hall, it tends to get pretty contentious. Do you have a view on how that could be reduced or bypassed? Is there a role for the provinces to use their inherent powers over cities to maybe shape things a bit better?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I can give an example of what we're working on right now as a way to inform the discussions, because I think that some of it has to be in identifying practical opportunities, bringing in the people responsible for making some of these decisions. We're working closely with Evergreen on our Urban Futures program that's looking at a 50-year infrastructure program, and that's working with local government, municipal government, and other partners as a way to move the conversation forward. And so that's one way that we're tackling it. And I think that it is a complex and it's also a complicated piece. But I think it's about having the conversation, having the right information, prototyping and testing new approaches, and then bringing people in who are the decision makers early on who can help drive that change.
Okay. So I want to circle back a bit to the question of how we get to this 100 million person Canada. So you've discussed immigration quite a bit. Do you see it mostly in immigration, or would there be efforts to increase births in Canada too? Is it kind of one, the other, both?
Immigration will be a key driver of population growth. And the reason why is that our fertility rate, our replacement level is insufficient. So what that actually means is that if we want people to have more children, then we need to encourage that with investments and supports that would allow that to happen. So our fertility rate right now is 1.54, and it's well below the replacement level of 2.1. So that's what I was getting at. So we know that right now the lack of these supports is one of the factors that contributes to the decision not to have more children. But we also know that the data shows mixed results in countries that have tried to incentivize a higher birth rate. And while financial support and other nudges may boost the fertility rate slightly, it is almost certainly not going to be enough to keep Canada's population at the same level, let alone grow. So immigration will be critical to our population growth. That's why we say, you'll often hear us say or see written in us write that it's simple math. Immigration is critical to our population growth. So how do we get to 100 million? We believe Canada is on the right path. The government of Canada announced an increase in immigration level targets, a 3-year plan. In 2019, it was 330,800, 341 in 2020, and then 350 in 2021. And in addition to that, so not just the numbers, but Canada also is using a broad set of policies to enable growth. So new investments in infrastructure, changes to the immigration system to provide faster access to top talent, enhancing foreign skills recognition, increasing family unification measures, and also more inclusionary policies to advance gender equality. But I think, you know, the pandemic has challenged those plans. Because of travel restrictions, Canada's 2020 plan, so it was meant to be 341,000 permanent residents, permanent resident admissions, we're not going to meet it. As of halfway through the year, so as of June 30th, permanent residency was granted to only 84,000 people. And that's just under 25% of the annual target. So the government's going to be really challenged in making up this shortfall. Our position, Centre Initiative, is advocating for, at minimum, the existing targets be met and piloting increased annual admissions.
All right. So how has COVID changed kind of your approach on what Canada needs to do?
Well, as I mentioned, we are still advocating for the same multi-year targets. And I don't believe I mentioned them earlier, but for good measure, 400,000 in 2022. So that was going to be only moderately up from the government target of 361. 420,000 in 2023, 450,000 in 2024, and then 475 in 2025. What that actually means is just pinning the annual immigration target to 1.25%. Today is just under 1%. So we are still advocating for that. I think what we're saying now is the government still needs to get there, but we recognize it's going to be tough. And piloting some approaches and measuring how that is working in terms of increasing those numbers is really important to understand what's working and what's not in communities.
Right. So this is basically an 80-year project, and kind of some rockiness in year one and two isn't going to really derail things too much. And you're kind of still focused on that long-term 2100.
Yeah.
Okay. There's been quite a few kind of COVID changes everything takes that I haven't been entirely sold on the long term, and kind of glad to hear that things are still looking ahead kind of regardless of that.
I don't think we have a choice otherwise.
Yeah, completely agree. So you've mentioned having more global influence, and the report that your organization put out for Bigger Better Canada mostly focuses on domestic issues. So I kind of want to get a better sense of what you're looking for in terms of global participation and influence.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we talk about international influence, we're talking about increasing our influence so that Canada has a stronger voice on issues that matter to us, like security, climate change, the North. And as we've seen recently, global issues like how do we respond to the pandemic? So what we're actually talking about is we're saying that population growth will be a critical factor in having a voice on issues globally that affect Canada. We don't go further to say what specific international issues. We don't have that broader agenda outside of our mandate, but simply to say without an increased population, it makes that potential for influence much lower.
All right, that made sense. So I kind of want to now pivot to discussing the North. That was one of the sections in the report about For a Bigger, Bolder Canada. So right now, most of Canada's population lives within 100 miles of the U.S. borders, where all the infrastructure is. Doesn't necessarily make sense to be greatly expanding population where there isn't that existing infrastructure to take advantage of.
Our population numbers in the North are small, both in real terms and relative to the rest of Canada. I think it's like 115,000. And this pales in comparison to Russia, which has 2 million people living in Arctic Russia. This has pretty significant implications for the future of the North and its oceans. So Canada must have a strong, vital presence on the world stage to advance our interests with respect to this very strategic, environmentally sensitive land. So, you know, to put in context, the Arctic Ocean's receding ice cover and the region's warming average temperatures are already spurring international interest for expanded shipping and mineral exploration in a really sensitive ecosystem. And that has pretty significant global climate implications. Without a Canadian presence in the North, there will be diminished stewardship of our economic and ecological future. More people are needed to drive the development and growth that we're going to benefit and that will benefit northern communities. But we know that to do this, we have to ensure that Indigenous leadership and vision are maintained. So this means that we must start with conversations, meaningful and respectful dialogue with Indigenous communities. But ultimately, we need to grow our population. It has strategic implications for us as a nation.
So yeah, history has not generally been that great when it comes to Canadians and settlers moving into new areas and areas that were predominantly inhabited by Indigenous people. If we do expand the Canadian population in the North, how do we make sure the past mistakes aren't repeated?
I think a big part of that is recognizing and owning the fact that there were mistakes and starting with conversation, dialogue, engagement with Indigenous communities. And so I do not have a straight path to say it's this or that. It has to start with conversation and engagement as a meaningful starting point.
So in terms of having a larger presence in the North, past governments have put some emphasis on building up northern ports. There's a naval port currently finishing construction right now, and there's an Arctic training area up there for our military. But one of the things with a small population is it means we just don't have much resources to put into defense. Do you see a role to have a larger population better support those efforts and enhance Arctic sovereignty in that way beyond just a civilian population in the North?
So, sorry, can you clarify your question? Do you mean enhancing our...
I guess the northern presence. You see that as mostly civilian-led, mid-civilian military. Kind of where do you see that, and how does a larger population, which can support a larger armed forces, play into that?
I think Century Initiative's position is simply that we need to bolster our population in the North. We recognize that it's complex. We recognize that it needs to be Indigenous-led, and it'll be quite involved. And so our starting point is let's raise awareness around this issue. Let's have a conversation about it. And then our next step is how do we partner with the right organizations, communities, and leaders to understand what's actually needed in order to make that happen.
So before I let you go, is there anything we didn't discuss that you feel is particularly relevant or you want mentioned?
Yes. So I actually want to end with, I think that we're all feeling really anxious right now, particularly because of COVID. I think that we need to meet Canadians where they're at and recognize that these are challenges. At the same time, we need to celebrate what we've always been proud of and also recognize that we have a strategic advantage in the world right now. Our openness to immigration, as well as a culture of multiculturalism and diversity. We have recognized the importance of immigration to secure our future, and we are recognized as having one of the leading immigration systems in the world. This means that we have a strong footing for in the global fight for talent. We have the vision, we have the tools to support this strategic advantage, and we should take it. But it's not just a job for government. Organizations like Century Initiative, businesses, your listeners, we all have a role to play in advancing what's really needed to ensure a strong, prosperous Canada. And we need to have this conversation now in order to make this happen.
Well said. So where can people go to find out more?
You can go to our website at centerinitiative.ca and also follow us on our social media channels, whether it's Twitter, LinkedIn. We're also on Facebook. So please do follow us, and you can also add yourself to our newsletter. Excellent. Through our website.
Lisa Luan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, moving on to our next segment, More No. This week, Finance Minister Bill Morneau resigned, both as minister and as an MP, and he's going to seek the leading role in the OECD. This comes after he was at the center of the Wii scandal, and there were many, many leaks to the press about all the ways him and Justin Trudeau weren't getting on.
Yeah, this was Monday afternoon, Monday evening that it came out. I guess he and Trudeau had a tete-a-tete, a meeting on Monday, and Morneau announced, you know, this has nothing to do with we. This doesn't even have to do with our difficulties with each other. This is all about me wanting to be the Secretary General of the OECD, something that no one really bought as a real reason to suddenly decide you want to up and leave as Finance Minister of Canada. So,
yeah, there's so much wrong with the story about wanting to go lead the OECD. First of all, no one expects Canada is going to get a seat in the next round of elections there. We had a senior one pretty recently, so that's weird. There's a potential that Bill Morneau actually is under the ethics rules where he can't work with anyone he's had significant dealings with, which, you know, the OECD and finance minister of a G7 country, they have significant dealings for 2 years. And also, like, it's really weird to just pack up and leave less than a year after being reelected.
And you said he was at the center of the Wii scandal. I would say he was adjacent to the center. I would say Justin Trudeau should be the center of the Wii scandal. The only person more center to that is Craig and Mark Kielberger.
Yeah, he's like in the first ring of the Wii scandal.
Yeah, his...
like direct family connections.
His $41,000 vacation bill that he didn't pay until
a couple weeks ago. Second only to the Prime Minister in being implicated in it.
But I think the press has largely quieted down on that. There, we'll talk a little bit about some of the leaks that have come out more recently, but the narrative being spun was this desire to shift going into the fall, and that's what the next round of news on Tuesday was, as Justin Trudeau announced that Chrystia Freeland, Deputy Prime Minister, fixer of all things, and the woman who wears many hats, is now Canada's first woman to serve as finance minister. Along with that announcement came the announcement that Parliament will also be prorogued until September 23rd. So all of the committees will be closed.
I think they were actually separated by a little bit of time. I don't think it was the same.
A few hours. They were both on Tuesday. I think when he went to Julie Payette, the governor general, to swear Chrystia Freeland in as finance minister, he probably also got the prorogation. You know, just to condense it all to one visit.
Probably. I mean, we know how much the governor general doesn't like to, you know, governor generaling. Is that the right verb? To governor general?
To do her formal job.
Yes.
That's fine. We're not here to talk about her this week. We are here to talk about, like, the move to put Chrystia Freeland in there, I guess, kills any idea that Mark Carney was going to get the job, at least for now. The prorogation was quite the news, though, as Justin Trudeau was pretty adamant in 2015 that he would never prorogue. And in fact, I think he was one of the first prime ministers to go an entire parliament without proroguing once, even as a matter of like, hey, it's a new year, let's start with a new legislative agenda.
Yeah. So, I mean, before we discuss the political implications of it, it's probably worth just touching on what proroguing is, which is basically parliament shuts down, everything that's happening right there stops, order papers get wiped clean. It's basically a fresh restart. Parliament comes back at some point when the prorogation ends, there's a throne speech, a confidence vote, and then they can get down to the business of legislating. Now, there's kind of two ways this actually happens in practice. There's the, you know, we're resetting the government, you know, unplugging and plugging back in Parliament to wipe the slate clean and kind of refresh everything. And that's often done in like a very pro forma way where, you know, Parliament's prorogued for like the long weekend or something.
Well, here in BC, when the throne speech is introduced on the first sitting of a new year, usually the prorogation ceremony happens like that morning. So there's actually like two sittings of the legislature on the same day. One is the last of the previous session where they say, all right, we've opened, we've done our prayer, prorogue, and then they're just done. And then they come back in the afternoon with the throne speech.
Yeah, so that's one way of doing it. The other way is rather than kind of resetting the modem of parliament by unplugging and plugging back in, there's the cutting all the phone lines approach to prorogation where you've just shut everything down because parliament's not a very fun place for you right about now.
Yeah, this is an effective way to dodge confidence votes, to escape scrutiny of parliamentary committees. And this is something that we've seen now, prime ministers of all stripes, from Jean Chrétien to Stephen Harper and now Justin Trudeau, use.
Yeah, and when they're in opposition, they all, you know, rant against how bad and terrible and undemocratic it is. But, you know, when there's an opportunity that suits them as prime minister, they're quick to jump on it.
Yeah, if Julie Payette wanted something, you know, meaningful to do with her job, here's where you could go. I'll grant you a prorogation, but you have to bring a throne speech in this afternoon. If that doesn't work for you, come back with your request that like 24 hours before you're introducing the throne speech. That and set the new precedent that prorogation can only be very short, except in extreme circumstances.
It sounds like a really good way to trigger constitutional crisis.
It would be fun, though.
Is a constitutional crisis in the midst of other crises fun?
It would be a distraction from we, but now we don't have to talk about we because no one will be allowed to talk about we, at least in the formal setting of parliamentary committees.
Yeah, now they can still, once parliament resumes, restart all that business because the committees are dominated by the opposition because minority parliaments are fun that way. But the other thing it's going to distract from is all the COVID that's going on and the plans to deal with that and the resulting economic fallout. So parliament not sitting also means parliament can't legislate things. And if you do need to restart things because, you know, legislation has to be quickly moved forward during a crisis to get stuff going, you know, have to go through a throne speech and a confidence vote and all that. Like, it's not, booting up the government isn't the quickest or easiest thing to do in this case, which makes it just reckless to do it during a crisis.
I think parliament had technically risen from its weird format it was running through the summer, which was not technically normal sessions, but like the COVID committee of the whole was running. The plan was to return in September anyway. So this is just basically shutting the doors formally until then. Now they could recall it sooner, I think, if there was an emergency. And, you know, they can fast track many of these things. A throne speech doesn't have to be a 2-hour event. It can be like 5 words and then they just get a bill and they can push it all through in a day or two if they really need to. But that said, there were a number of bills on the order paper, like, for example, the bill to change Canada's assisted dying laws, which the government has now asked for 2 extensions to a Quebec Superior Court ruling that found part of the existing laws to be unconstitutional. The government now has until December 18th. They had a bill that was at first reading that would have done what they needed to do. I didn't think it was a perfect bill, but it was a bill. And now they have to start from zero, or else just parts of the law disappear, which I think the government has not wanted to do. So they have work to do.
It's all around just a very messy situation. And like, to the extent that this government thinks strategically, which is not always apparent, they, I guess, made the calculation that better to survive politically and turn down the heat a bit than, you know, do the governing they're supposed to be doing.
The other angle on it is the potential that Trudeau sees that his opposition is weak in many different ways. The Conservatives are coming through a leadership race, which we'll talk about in a second. The NDP are broke. The Bloc are saber rattling and probably could fight an election, but that's about it. So you can come forward now, say, all right, I'm going to bring forward this throne speech, possibly a full budget in October, give you a bunch of confidence votes and dare you to send me to an election. Because if Trudeau comes back having won an election, either as a, you know, kind of status quo or increases his seat count, he can pretty much put we behind him and say he's got a new, fresh mandate from the peoples.
That's risky and unlikely in a couple categories. First off, the new COVID EI thing that's replacing the CERB, it's coming in on September 27th, and that needs legislation to happen. And I don't think we've actually mentioned the date, but the scheduled return of Parliament after the prorogation is September 23rd. So, like, the NDP at the very least, and probably everyone else, isn't going to torpedo, you know, that just as Parliament reopens. Because, I mean, the blowback on leaving millions of Canadians stranded without some sort of benefit in these times would be massive. So that's not going to happen. And same thing with the budget speed. Like, it's, unless they really screw up, it's unlikely that there's going to be enough in the budget for all the parties to vote it down.
It does give the NDP the strong ability to try to push for something bigger and to push Trudeau to really move forward. Like, this is, I think, the time when the opposition party should be playing a little bit harder ball. It's a risky game all around, but like, if Trudeau's talking this big game, and if you're the party that says we need a big game to be played, you gotta take this opportunity. Like, if the NDP wants to go for basic income, now seems like the time to push for it, or something big like that. But let's talk, you mentioned the CERB transition plan. So this had been talked vaguely about, and we just got the details today for how the CERB, Canada Emergency Response Benefit, the $2,000 a month that many people were getting, like millions of people were getting, and were set to not get very soon when it expired, is being replaced by a revamped EI. So the first step is to extend CERB for another 4 weeks to September 27th, just to give them some flexibility time to, like you said, bring in the bills they need to bring in these new additional recovery benefits. The key bit about how most people will go on to EI is some of the requirements for EI are going to drop. I think you needed to have worked 400 or 500 hours in the past year to qualify for EI. Typically, that's going to drop to 120, and you'll get at least $400 a week, which will be pretty good for a lot of people. And I think beyond that, it's like 55% of your salary otherwise. There are also three new additional recovery benefits. There's the Canada Recovery Benefit, which is the way to cover everyone who's a precarious worker, a gig worker, someone who doesn't have like a clear salary, self-employed people. They will qualify for $400 a week, and they could get that for up to 26 weeks. There's the Canada Recovery Sickness Benefit. This, as far as I can tell, is the paid sick leave. It's 10 days for those who are unable to work due to having COVID-19 or needing to isolate for COVID-19. It's not paid sick leave, it's COVID sick leave, and it'll be here temporarily. I mean, it's good that it's there. And finally, there's the Canada Recovery Caregiver Benefit. This is for anyone who needs to stay home because either their kid's school or daycare is closed, or a doctor has told them that you need to keep your kid home because they're at risk of COVID, and they will be eligible for $500 a week as well. So fairly broad. It seems like it covers most realms. I know the CCPA has been looking very carefully at this transition and whether the revamping will cover everyone who is going to come off of CERB, because it's a lot of people.
Yeah, the transition is going to be tough, in part because the CERB's done by the CRA, the Canada Revenue Agency, but EI isn't. So you're going to have to transfer millions of people from one bureaucracy to another. It's not necessarily going to be easy, and there will probably be people slipping through the cracks on this one.
These are all also temporary benefits, and there's a good argument that many of these things or similar things should be more permanent. Like, if people have many medical reasons they can't have their children in school, or the paid sick leave. We've talked about on the show how important that is just in normal times to ensure people aren't spreading diseases, which can always affect the most vulnerable. So there's a good argument, I think, for these being more permanent, but at least they're here for a start. And it's not clear how long they'll be here, though.
Well, I think the EI tops out at 45 weeks, starts with a four. So the better part of a year, I think EI covers. And on the permanent, so yeah, sick leave absolutely made sense as a permanent one. The suggestions that, you know, the CERB becomes like a UBI, universal basic income type program. I mean, that's a very big, massive structural change that you don't want to just rush into. And you go back several weeks now into our archives and listen to the interview with Lindsay Tedds on all the challenges there. So it's maybe one of those things that you don't want to rush into.
Well, we'll have to keep our eye on this and see how things progress. I expect we'll see lots more rolled out by the federal government in advance of this candy-laden budget that Trudeau is going to roll out in October. Moving on to our final segment, catching up on the Conservative leadership race. We have four candidates coming in on the final days of voting before we find out who gets to replace Andrew Scheer.
So the leadership race has been going on since the loss by Andrew Scheer and subsequent resignation as leader of the Conservative Party after the last election.
Let's be real. It's been going on since 2015, since Stephen Harper stepped down that election night unceremoniously.
Well, some of the people didn't run that time. Like Peter McKay sat that last one out. So tomorrow, or today when you're listening to this, on Friday the 21st, it's 5 p.m. Eastern is when all the ballots have to be in by. We'll get the answer this weekend on who actually won. It's a riding-weighted ranked choice system. So every riding gets 100 points, and people rank their preferred candidates. Last one gets dropped off the ballot. Their votes get redistributed. So it's a case where ridings really matter, and 100 people in, you know, a riding in Quebec that's never voted Conservative ever can matter just as much as the most Conservative riding with 3,000 members in Alberta.
Yeah, it's a system that makes sense in a country that elects leaders and elects governments based on single member plurality ridings. So you need to be competitive in every part of the country to win a federal election, so you should reasonably be competitive in every part of the country to win your party leadership. It's a messy system, but it does make sense.
Yeah, it made sense for coalitional parties like the Conservative Party is as well, where you have a lot of different factions vying for it. You don't want, you know, the Western bloc of them to dominate.
Well, let's run through this quick. There's four leadership candidates. They're all Conservatives, so they're all obviously against the carbon tax. They're against the bills C-48 and C-69, the ones they call the anti-pipeline bills. They love balancing the budget, dropping taxes. What differentiates these four?
Right. So I guess first off, Peter McKay, he's the former leader of the Progressive Conservatives who merged it with the Alliance under Stephen Harper to form the Conservative Party of Canada, former Justice Minister, former Minister of National Defense.
He's got 47 MPs behind him. He's the most endorsed of any of the leadership candidates.
Yeah, widely considered to be kind of the front runner. It's general, what little polling we have has generally put him ahead, but not by like such a wide margin that he has a lock on it.
Yeah, I think he's got the most name recognition among the broader public, but within the Conservative Party itself, he's not run a great campaign, and it was a lot of gaffes in the early bits, so...
Yeah, it was a running joke among the punditry and Twitter as well about just how terrible the Peter McKay campaign was. To say it was amateur hour would be an insult to amateurs, I think. But he's kind of cleaned it up, and the back half of the campaign seems to have been run fairly well. So yeah, decent shot at it, but like front runners in ranked choice leadership votes, but a disadvantage if they can't clear the first ballot, because anyone who isn't voting for the front runner generally has a reason not to vote for the front runner, which means they generally don't pick up as much on the second and third ballots.
Yeah, McKay is also somewhat positioned as the moderate of the candidates, whereas O'Toole, who we'll get to, is a little bit more on the conservative side, and then you have two far-right candidates. And so
yeah,
you need to pick up those far-right votes, unfortunately, to win.
Yeah, O'Toole was also like the moderate candidate last time, and has definitely shifted more towards the right to kind of differentiate himself from another Eastern Canadian moderate running in Peter McKay. So Peter McKay is running a pretty generic centrist front runner campaign, really putting the emphasis on jobs, has a bunch of stuff in his platform around that, plus the usual Conservative Party platform promises.
Yeah, there's a bunch of wonky stuff in here, from changes to RRSPs and tax-free savings accounts to like a digital first government services. And that's all fine, you know, standard conservative stuff. A bit more on the like no Huawei 5G, use the Five Eyes. Invest in that a bit more. He does.
Yeah, so
go ahead.
So the Five Eyes is the intelligence alliance between us, the US, the UK, New Zealand, and Australia. And in addition to not having Huawei in any of those countries, McKay wants to basically do a joint project to develop internally within the intelligence alliance the 5G equipment and manufacturer to, you know, really make it secure.
And he's the one who would say he would march in the Toronto Pride Parade. I mean, assuming they would let him, because I know some of the Pride Parades have taken to being a bit more strict with conservative parties if they don't show a commitment to queer issues.
Well, McKay's main rival and the other highly likely winner of the race is Erin O'Toole, being the kind of in the runner-up position the whole time, but very much in range of winning this thing. So he ran in the last leadership race, finished a fairly respectable third, just behind Scheer and Maxime Bernier. Yeah. He's a former Air Force officer, former Minister of Veterans Affairs. He's like we talked about at the start of the... He's very much in like the moderate lane of the Conservative Party, but because the moderate lane was already filled, he kind of shifted a bit more towards the center of gravity of the party.
Yeah, so he's got the second most number of endorsements, 38 MPs across the country, including BC's Mark Dalton and a bunch I've never heard of, Kenny Chu, Tracy Gray, and Brad Viss, Chuck Strahl, former MP, and notably Jason Kenney, Premier of Alberta, who I think managed to round up a lot of the UCP caucus to also throw endorsements at Erin O'Toole. So
yeah, Kenny was an early endorser and really kind of pushed the don't want Peter McKay to be the leader.
And that's quite notable, as like premiers don't tend to weigh in on federal leadership races.
Yeah, it was a little unusual in that way.
So O'Toole, like you say, moderate policies for the large part, but like messaging that tried to play to the more right-wing base of a couple of the other candidates. I think the most like aggressive policy he's putting forward is to invoke the notwithstanding clause to ensure mandatory minimum sentences stay in place for trafficking illegal handguns, or the most violent crimes such as murder, kidnapping, sexual assault. And notably, the courts have repeatedly across the states and Canada found mandatory minimums to be cruel and unusual punishment.
Yeah, so that's the one that really kind of stuck out to me. Well, one of the two things that stuck out to me when I was reading his platform. That definitely red meat to the base. The other one was, well, not red meat, but other food, was he wants to protect our food supply by investing in greenhouse infrastructure, which it's nowhere near the most important thing in this platform, but like, it just seems really weird because like Canada's a massive exporter of food anyway. And like, is the thing that's stopping us from having a secure food supply a lack of greenhouses in Canada?
This feels like a policy that there's like someone on his campaign who is really hung up on and knows this issue inside and out, and is like, there is a specific law or regulation that is preventing 80 people in this country, maybe it's a little bit more, from building greenhouses faster. Yeah, and they really want to change that. And it's not like it's necessarily good or bad. It's just weird to people who don't understand it, like me.
Yeah.
I grew up on a farm, but we didn't have greenhouses.
Really feels like that's a sort of thing that like came out of a campaign stop somewhere where someone like talked his ear off about the importance of greenhouses. Yeah. Just one of those weird little policies that is kind of what I like about leadership races, is in addition to like the very generic stuff that like the party will put in its next platform, you have all of these like weird little pet issues.
A little bit less of a pet issue for O'Toole, though, is that he wants to wind down CERB and other emergency benefits on some unknown timeline. But he would replace that with an extended EI that would cover those who aren't covered today.
Yeah, so in some ways kind of similar to what we were talking about in the previous segment. Also firmly anti-Huawei, wants to onshore a lot of like the critical manufacturing stuff for PPE, which McKay also has, but we didn't mention in when we were talking about his platform. And then the other couple things that stand out for me on there was support for a small modular reactor industry. So basically getting a new nuclear power industry up and running, but on a much more cost-effective, easier to roll out way than past generations of nuclear. And the other one is support for the Kansik Union Alliance, general working togetherness of us, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK, which was in his platform last time too. And he's been like one of the main proponents of in Canada in general.
Yeah, I think both of those are ideas that are interesting. I think the specifics kind of kill both of them. Like the reactors, I like the idea, but the financial feasibility always becomes a question, and maybe that's where the government needs to step in. And Kansuk is nice, but we all geographically aren't the most logical trading partners, as much as we do share a lot of culture. But you know, again, not necessarily opposed to it, but just like, yeah, fine.
Yeah, on the small reactor thing, like part of the reason that approach has been taken is because it does get around a bunch of the cost issues that have plagued previous generations, where like you make giant bespoke reactor systems and power plants every time you want to build one, rather than a smaller system that you can, you know, make just repeated ones in mass production and get them out a lot quicker. So that one's, I think can't happen without government support, but he's very worth putting a lot of support behind.
Well, maybe let's change from the sort of quirky ideas of the primary candidates to the quirky candidates of the secondary level of the race. But we may even need to revisit that.
There's three tiers in this one. You have your top two who are, you know, as close as we can tell, you know,
tied.
Yeah. Neck and neck ish. Maybe McKay's been ahead the whole time, but like not so obviously so that he runs away with it. Then you have your next tier
of Leslyn Lewis,
and the final tier of that slightly nutty guy that most people are kind of embarrassed by, and it's almost certain to finish last.
So let's talk about Leslyn Lewis first. She's a lawyer and a former candidate without much other political experience, but she has suddenly like come up, and we'll talk briefly. Maybe we won't quite have time, and I'll just throw the link in the show notes to Eric Grenier's analysis of fundraising. But Leslyn Lewis in this last quarter has pulled in like a respectable amount. She got more donors than Peter McKay and was like 100 fewer than Erin O'Toole, with 13,000, you know, 200 to 100 between them. So both raising, you know, all raising like $1.8 to $3.1 million. So she is in there in this last round. She has seven MPs endorsing her, including Dean Del Maestro, Pierre Lemieux, who was the former leadership candidate. I mean, half of the caucus was a leadership candidate in the last election, but you know, he was prominent among them, among the social conservatives. John Cummins, Scott Reed, who weirdly is in that list because he's not really among the more right wing as far as I got. He was more of just the wonky democratic reform guy.
He's a little idiosyncratic.
Fair enough. I guess she does have some reform the party internally positions that the others don't. She's also got Lyle Olberg, who is a former Alberta finance minister, Bill Bennett, the former BC minister of energy and mines, and Sam Oosterhoff, who's the famous, I think he's the youngest MPP in Ontario, and he's a very notable anti-choice advocate, which I think brings us to the core of like Leslyn Lewis's platform. One of which is like no hidden agenda. And she says the only way to avoid being accused of having a hidden agenda is to not hide it. And so she does talk about how pro-life she is. And here are the like four ways she would try to ban abortion in Canada. And it wouldn't be a full outright one. It would be like sex selective stuff and stuff. But, you know, if that's your candidate, and apparently she's got quite a bit of support for it, there she is.
Yeah. So she's positioned herself as kind of the mainstay social conservative person in the race, but also someone who's generated like a fair bit of buzz from the grassroots. And like the first two guys on the list we were talking about, they ran very boring campaigns that like didn't generate much buzz, but from what I hear, like rank and file conservatives are giving Leslyn Lewis a lot more attention than I think anyone expected going into this.
I think maybe it comes around the first couple things on her platform, which are ensuring fair nominations and more grassroots policies at conventions. When you talk to people who are involved in political parties of basically any color, one of the things you will hear a lot is that being a member is kind of pointless because you can never get the policies you actually care about to convention. And a lot of the important races are somewhat de facto stacked, or in some cases, just like in some parties, only specific candidates can run. So
yeah,
when you're running as leader and you need the votes of members, saying I will give my members more choice and more power is appealing, even if sometimes the members are dumb and make bad choices politically.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, someone always runs on that platform, and it's never been a huge, you know, the ticket to success. I can't think of a leader who got elected primarily on a, I'm going to, you know, make the internal party working slightly better, rather than I'm the best person to contest the next election, or I'm the person who like speaks to the id of the party the best.
Yeah. The rest of Lewis's platform is largely social conservative stuff. She talks about ending political correctness, but doesn't really define either what that is or how she would do it. She would allow free votes on conscious issues. She would oppose the conversion therapy ban and that's been proposed, and the remove trans rights from the Human Rights Act. And she would stop expansions of medical assistance in dying. So, yeah, pretty strong evangelical social conservative stuff.
Yeah, there's also the other candidate on there to mention the small modular reactors thing, which I found kind of interesting that it was picked up by not just one candidate.
Oh yeah, and she mentioned the UN Global Compact on Migration, which was the like racist conspiracy thing of conservatives a couple years ago. Fun times.
Well, should we move on to the person who's taken that idea and run with it the most?
Yeah, Derek Sloan, who on paper should be ahead of Leslyn Lewis because he is actually an elected and sitting MP, also a lawyer, but I think screwed up early on and got shot his mouth off maybe a bit too much and became clear he was the like person running on essentially all the same stuff as Leslyn Lewis, but like the obvious bigot of the two. And whereas Leslyn Lewis, I should mention, is a black woman versus Derek Sloan is like exactly who you'd expect to be running on this platform.
Yeah, so he's making the like very popular social conservative stuff, like the bread and butter of his campaign. Exactly what you'd expect there. Plus some COVID-specific stuff. So he's...
Oh, but first, I should say he's been endorsed by former leadership candidate who did actually quite well, Brad Trost, and media-type person, Ezra Levant, which is quite the backing behind you.
Yeah, Derek Sloan's really like leaned into the popular stuff, particularly as COVID's come around. So he's being like a vocal anti-masker. Part of his platform is no mandatory COVID vaccines. Like, very much kind of positioned himself in like the Trump mold in that way.
I also like this thing he has on here about making it illegal for an online platform to ban someone unless they've been documented breaking the law. Like, yeah, he just wants the internet to be unusable.
Yeah, like anyone who spent any time on like any social media, going back to like the original like forums and stuff, you gotta have a way to ban people. Otherwise, it just becomes like the most troll infested place ever. It's such a nonsensical idea.
Yeah. Luckily, he's not going to win. My worry is Lewis is like weirdly strong in this. If she edges out McKay or O'Toole, she has a path to victory. I think she would have to edge out O'Toole on the first ballot.
Yeah.
But
it's unlikely, but yeah, if she does clear that big hurdle, it does put in a pretty strong position for round two.
Beyond that, any predictions?
So the McKay campaign said they've sold the most memberships. The polling puts them ahead. But like, I think this is, if I was to guess, most likely going to be a third round narrow O'Toole victory.
Yeah, I think that's the safest like second bet. And third. And where I'd probably put my money to. I would maybe throw a little bit of cash on the Leslyn Lewis surprise victory. Which
really?
Well, it would be a long shot bet, and maybe you'd make some good money on there.
Yeah, that's
no true. One's given me good odds on it yet, or good enough odds. In any case,
yeah. McKay's like the super safe, like most, you know, thing that like the pundits who want to just play it safe are predicting. But
he needs to win it on the first round, really.
Pardon?
McKay would really need to win it on the first round.
Yeah, or come in like 49%. I just need a scattering of second and third choice votes.
In any case, at this point, I'm not sure any are quite strong enough to take on Trudeau, although O'Toole might do well. McKay would need to do better than he campaigned on the early part of this leadership race.
Although, like the campaign in the last half's been notably better. I think it could definitely...
It's just been notably quiet on all parts.
Take him on better. And like, Andrew Scheer was an absolute dud, and he still won the popular vote and came fairly close to... Like, definitely did better than anyone predicted the Conservatives would have done, looking at how the party was when they voted in their last leader. And that's mostly because Trudeau shot himself in the foot in a couple of ways during that time. But like, there's definitely a possibility that anyone who made some fairly marginal improvements and runs a campaign that isn't entirely about driving up support among the base and actually winning seats in Ontario would win. And in that respect, either McKay or O'Toole would be fine and likely to give a respectable show and quite possibly win.
Well, we'll know soon enough, and we'll have to follow the adventures of the new leader as they try and take on Justin Trudeau.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/splitghost. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Splitghost is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.